Lecture 21, Etruscan Families.
The Etruscans are almost completely responsible for the Western notion of family. And they originated the very idea of the family name in Europe. As we explore Etruscan naming practices in this lecture, and what such practices reveal about their families, we'll also see what they tell us about Etruscan ties of mutual support and comfort. Historical naming practices are the wonkiest thing I've ever taught, and Etruscan naming practices differ from those of all other ancient peoples. For comparison, let's start with the ancient Hebrews. Ancient Hebrew naming practices included no family names. Knowing the identity of the father was sufficient, and there was no need to profess connection to a larger group in the name. Also, the mother, or the mother's father, more to the point, was invisible in this system. The relationship to the father was all critical. And so Hebrew naming practice followed the pattern of X, son or daughter, of Y. This would be a personal name, followed by what is called a patronymic, the father's name. In Hebrew, examples could be Joshua ben Joseph or Rachel bat Aaron. The ben and bat indicate son of or daughter of. It's a formula for nomads and those who follow flocks, who are also a fairly homogeneous people, so that no other distinction need be applied to distinguish one from another. Not from each other, nor from outsiders. And yet, very interestingly, Hebrews accepted the idea that a name meant something. Like his name, so is he, in 1 Samuel 25:25, refers to a specific person's name and the correspondence of that name to his character. Well, the ancient Greek situation was slightly more complicated. At Athens, for example, they would add a patronymic and a man's deme or tribe to the personal name. So it might have three elements instead of the more traditional two. From the 4th century BC on, we see the rise of more names patterned as X of place, place called a locative, such as Enthymius of Tralles, or more notably, Socrates of Athens. This is a name pattern for city dwellers who privilege that portion of their identity above their patronym or tribe. Once again, none of these have family names. The emphasis is on one marker of identity beyond the personal name, either place or descent from a father. Now, about those Etruscans. Their naming system was distinguished from others by containing a family name of patrilineal descent added to the personal name. In Latin, this was referred to as the nomen gentilicium, or just nomen, name. And that's significant because it redefines one's most important name from the personal to the family. The family name is literally one's name. And the personal name becomes a prename, giving powerful evidence of the centrality of family in Etruscan culture. Well, what about the patronymic? That's there too, giving us the three-name formula eventually passed down to the Romans and through them to the Western world. For example, Arnth Papnos Titus, which is Arnth Papnos, son of Tite, or Arnth Velimnus Aules, Arnth Velimnus, son of Aule. Is that it? The big reveal is the use or invention of family names? Well, yeah. For the first time, a standard, unchanging name could be used to distinguish an entire subgroup of people within a community or culture. Other surname traditions are adapted patronymics or cognomina, such as the Scandinavian pattern with son on the end. Still, that three-name formula is not quite all that we get from Etruscan names. Etruscan names also regularly make use of matronymics, that is, the mother's name, or gamonymic, wife of, and cognomen, an extra personal name sometimes indicating a branch of the gentilicium. Occasionally, gamonymics include the noun pua, wife. For example, Thankville Suplini, Larthiolissa Caes Centinates Pua. Thankville Suplini, the daughter of Larth, wife of Cae Centinates. Or Velia Seanti Arnth Unatnal Cumarunia Rathumnasa. Velia Seanti, daughter of Arnth, and a woman of Unatna Cumarunia, wife of Rathumna. Let me point out that the wife's full name was given in the most developed examples of the naming formula. This represents a difference from, say, Spanish names, where the husband and wife's surnames are often joined by the letter Y, meaning and. That gives the mistaken impression that the wife's name in Spain is as important as the husband's, while it's actually her surname, so her father's name. In other words, the resulting combined family name records the joining of two male lines, the husband's and the father's, her father's. And so the apparent gender equality is an illusion. In contrast, the Etruscan naming system was designed to represent a very complex, sophisticated family structure in which, for example, married women did not just leave their father's family and become part of their husband's. Or as it says in Genesis 2:24, "Therefore shall a man leave his father and his mother, and shall cleave unto his wife, and they shall be one flesh." For the ancient Hebrews, each marriage created a new family. No need for family names in that instance. For the Etruscans, the concept of family was more inclusive and extensive. The Etruscan system reflected a society that was not tribal. The Etruscans lived in a world defined by connections between families in one particular community, as well as linking that community to others. Family was a prioritized identity for both men and women, and it seems that family transcended even city-state as an identifying principle. Think about how this differs even from the Roman system that inherited the surname. Roman women rarely had what we could call their own name. They generally carried only one name, either their father's name in the feminine or their husband's. For example, Julius Caesar's daughter was Julia. If he hypothetically had three daughters, they would have the added element of prima, secunda, or tertia, that is first, second, or third, appended to their name. And if Julia Prima died, the surviving daughters would move up in the birth order and become prima and secunda, literally their names changing. Etruscan women are of equal importance with men in defining the family, and they have their own personal and legal identity. We can see reflections of that in their ability to inherit and will property, setting them apart from their contemporaries in other cultures. In ancient Athens, for example, women were forbidden to transact any financial business above the level of what was needed to purchase food for a family for a week. Beyond that, she needed the approval from her male guardian. Furthermore, Etruscan women could serve as heads of their own households. Of the 124 tombs in one necropolis at Orvieto, six are carved with the names of women over the doors. This leads us to conclude that these names were the property owners and the heads of households buried within. Now, I'm not saying the Etruscans had a society approaching a matriarchy ruled by women, or even matrilineal dominated society, referring to descent from women, but it displays elements of remarkable equality. This is further on display in the many family tombs that have been excavated, and which were designed to create an interior burial space for pairs of beds, final resting places for husband and wife. If domestic structure is anything to go on, and I think it is, it provides further evidence of a remarkably equitable marriage arrangement between Etruscan men and women. It was the wife's funerary bed that identified her with the family through its headboard, which was shaped like a peaked house roof. Etruscan tomb forms indicate that women and children were not restricted to exclusive areas in the home, nor were there exclusively male areas. The structures of the houses of virtually all periods and places show consistent symmetry and no evidence of what is termed monofunctionality of rooms. They have nothing that approximates the Greek custom of designating one room the andron, usually a large room on the ground floor of a Greek home that was exclusively male space and particularly designed to host the symposium, the exclusively male drinking party. The remains of actual Etruscan houses at a wide number of sites, from Aqua Rossa, Veii, Vetulonia, Merlo, and Marzabotto, for example, support the conclusion drawn from the tomb material. Marital equality was the Etruscan norm. Now, on to the subject of life expectancy. U.S. white males had a life expectancy at birth of 48 years in 1900, while white women might expect to live 51 years, with other women 35. Non-white males could expect to live only about 32 years. These differences reflect such filters as healthcare, dangers from death by work-related injuries, childbirth, etc. Etruscan life expectancies based on their funerary monuments give us comparable data. Keeping in mind that these are skewed in favor of the wealthier, who were more likely to have larger, better preserved tomb markers, we have the results of two studies. One, for southern Etruria, calculates a lifespan for women of 44 years and men 49 years. At Volterra in central Etruria, another study puts the numbers at 48 for women and 46 for men. Overall, fairly comparable to the U.S. numbers from 1900. We also have some very compelling information on Etruscan views of marriage from stories told in their myths. Myths are very important indicators of cultural values and social structure. For example, in Greek myth, individual heroes roam the countryside performing acts of mayhem under the shelter of the concept of autonomous violence. That is, the expectation that they alone will decide who or what needs to be attacked and under what conditions. They defer to no higher authority. And when they get together in groups, it's usually a disaster, whether it's the Argonauts searching for the Golden Fleece or Greek heroes at Troy. It never goes smoothly. Greek culture relished individual rather than collective achievement. Their Olympic Games, for instance, featured no team sports, only individual ones. Their myths reflected their world and its values. Now think about the Etruscan hero myths we know most about. They involve the exploits of the brothers, Aule and Caile Vipinos. Once again, family is a defining element of their identity. By comparison, myths of heroic brothers are very rare in Greek culture, which emphasizes the achievements of a single male. When it comes to Greek myths about family, Zeus and Hera, as one example, do not have what we would consider a healthy, functional relationship. He wields ultimate power. He's a serial adulterer and occasional rapist. Hera lashes out at those that he rapes or seduces and their offspring. Both, seem indifferent to the conflict they create and the awful effects on one another. Things break down to the point that each has a child independently, that is, on their own, with no help from anyone else. The multi-generational family model is equally unsettled in Greek myth. In each generation, the male ruler god is eventually attacked and overthrown by his youngest son. Now, these are exciting stories full of conflict and drama, but they provide such poor role models that Plato banned stories of the immoral Olympian gods from his ideal republic. Well, how does this dark view of family contrast with Etruscan myths of gods and their families? The principal god of the Etruscans was Tinia, and his consort was Uni. They're far from Zeus and Hera. Although there are images of Tinia and goddesses other than Uni in Etruscan art, they're amazingly rare, and they come about only as variations of Greek myth in later Etruscan art. The more purely Etruscan images of this divine couple show them as a loving pair, often embracing, generally in the presence of an attendant with perfume or playing music. These are scenes of love. They mutually reach out and hold one another, in stark contrast to the marriage scenes of Zeus and Hera, where he grabs her by the wrist and pulls her towards him with a gesture of control, if not dominance. The depictions of Tinia also reinforce his role as a patron god of fertility, reproduction, and the protection of children, aspects completely missing from the duties of Zeus. There are a number of scenes of Etruscan deities nurturing or caring for children in ways unparalleled in Greek or Roman myth. Tinia personally oversees the handing over of the infant Epeor to Hercle, who, along with Minerva, act as foster parents to this child. Tinia also expresses more of a peacekeeping element to his lightning throwing than does Zeus or Jupiter. Furthermore, his decisions of when or even whether to intervene are not made autonomously. He confers with the other gods in his divine family. This concept, known in Latin as concilium, is an important check on male abuse of power, where the patriarch figure must request the counsel of his family prior to any significant action. We see that in the imagery of Tinia, as he consults with a number of other Etruscan deities, most often Termes and Aplu. Once again, the Etruscan idea of family displays strong differences between them and the Greeks. Perhaps the best indicator of the Etruscan preference for family, children, and romance is how the Etruscans took Greek myths of conflict and doomed love and altered them to meet their own cultural requirements. We can see this in the stories of Minerva, the Greek Athena. For the Etruscans, Minerva is often a nurturing figure who's frequently seen with infants in her care, sometimes three or four at once. By contrast, the Greek virgin goddess Athena guides adult male heroes, but does not care for infants. Similarly, Uni, unlike her counterpart Hera, cares for children, even those of her husband by others. She aids with the birth of Minerva, Tinia's daughter, who he gave birth to himself. Also, rather than attempting to kill him, she suckles Hercle, ensuring his acceptance into the company of the gods. The Etruscan notions of societal-wide care for the young and an inclusive definition of family lead to these alterations. Another example is found in a number of myths of Aphrodite, the Etruscan Tauren. Her loves in the Greek canon of myth are pretty much universally doomed. She and Ares are adulterous lovers caught by her husband Hephaestus, for example. She loves and loses the hunter Adonis, and so on. In the Etruscan versions, the adulterous element is missing, and the loss is downplayed or non-existent. The imagery of Turin and Autunus, who's Adonis, in Etruscan art emphasizes their mutual love, often in the company of other deities. The compositions are very similar to the Uni and Tinia scenes, showing the pair's contentment with none of the conflict, loss, or sorrow of the Greek versions. Furthermore, Turin, like Uni and Minerva, is known in Etruscan myth for caring for infants. The epithet Ati, mother, is sometimes applied to her as well. I've been trying to decide what it means that in Etruscan myth, the Trojan prince Paris and the Greek Helen, whose abduction or affair began the Trojan War, end up together as an exemplary couple. It seems to indicate a strain of romanticism that Greek myth lacks. Come to think of it, no one seems to live happily ever after in Greek myths. It's as though Greek myths are stories to prepare one for the worst possible outcome, while Etruscan myths take the same figures and encourage a reading based on the best possible outcome. And through the course of Paris and Helen's relationship, from their meeting to the birth of their child, Etruscan art puts Turin on the scene as a sort of patron deity, protector, and mediator. The Etruscans dramatically alter the story of Helen, as she does not return to her husband Menelaus, but stays with Paris and has a child with him instead, adding to the large number of children known from Etruscan myth. Well, it's clear to scholars that Etruscan myth was almost aggressively socially normative. That is, it conveyed critical social roles and values to those who heard or read or saw the stories in art. Love affairs end in lifelong love, and even the children of adulterous relationships are raised in a loving family. None are attacked by monsters sent by the jealous wife. Yes, I'm looking at you, Hera. Images of children at all stages of life, from birth to adulthood, are found in Etruscan art. This contrasts with children's invisibility in Roman art, until the Emperor Augustus needed them to found a dynasty. We find Etruscan mothers nursing their children, a departure from the Greek habit of almost never showing this daily event, and the Roman of using it only as a trope for extraordinary female piety. The care of Etruscan children was socialized to the entire family, in many ways to the entire community. From birth, images of them are shown that demonstrate the care they received, from parents especially. Amulets protected children from birth to adulthood. Contrast that with the infant exposure in the Greek world or infant sacrifice in the Phoenician. Furthermore, Etruscan children took part in public social occasions with their parents, mimicking their behavior and learning their social roles as a family, rather than, as we know from the contemporary Greek world, by gender. How Etruscan children were raised, of course, varied enormously, depending on the period and class of the parents. We know that boys and girls alike were educated, at least to the extent of literacy. That doesn't mean that they were raised identically, of course. Gender roles are pretty solidified in the ancient world. For boys, that meant work outside the home, whether in fields, literally in the fields growing crops, or in trade, or in one of the areas of technical work at which the Etruscans excelled, such as what we today would call civil engineering. Boys were also trained to undertake civic, military, and religious duties when they became men. Divination was another area of specialized male education. Many Etruscan boys began training early in divination, studying the many books and rituals involved in this terribly complex but very important ritual. Girls were trained in the usual domestic duties, which differed somewhat depending on class. One constant for girls, no matter what social class, was creating fabric. All girls were taught to spin wool into yarn and then dye and weave that into cloth. This was an incredibly time-consuming but essential household task. It was undertaken by women who could sit and spin or weave in a courtyard or designated room in the house. It was undertaken almost invariably with other women, making it a social occasion, and one that was secondarily educational, as they sang songs and told stories while they worked. Some scholars think that stories and myths were created and transmitted during these long sessions that would otherwise occupy only part of one's mind. Let me remind you of the scandalous quote from the Greek historian Theopompus. "The children live the way their parents live, often attending drinking parties and having sexual relation with all the women." Well, I can refute at length the notion that Etruscan children were drinking and having sex with all the women. I think we can gain some meaning from this quote. Theopompus was offended and outraged at differences he saw between Greek and Etruscan societies, and it's this attitude that colored his views. Here's the real point he was raising. In ancient Greek society, children were socially invisible, and children and respectable women would certainly not be present at exclusively male drinking parties. I think we can draw the conclusion that the exact opposite was the case at Etruscan banquets, there being no better correspondence to the Greek symposium or drinking party that he refers to. Families socialized together in public, including both genders and all ages. Theopompus goes on to claim that Etruscan women exercised in the nude or participated in sports as men did. These might be true, although there's no corroborating evidence. Or they might be garbled versions of the attested female role as spectators of sport, along with men. Another element of female public life with ample evidence among the Etruscans, but not seen in the Greek world. In a number of ways, family structure and family life is very much a constant around the world. But when there are variations that show a particular society deviates from the norms of their chronological or geographical context, these are indicative of unique cultural qualities. And the Etruscan culture developed in ways that distinguish its society from those of its neighbors. Two images, I think, serve as shorthand for the centrality in Etruscan culture of equal marriage in defining the family. The first is the 6th century BC Sarcophagus of the Spouses from Cerveteri. This life-size terracotta sculpture of a smiling, reclining couple on their dining and burial couch is the very image of a happy couple. I'm not saying this reflected reality, only that it represented the ideal. Significantly, the figures are together, the same size, and neither upstages the other. Each of these aspects contrasts with Greek pieces from the same period, where figures are distinguished by being in higher scale or higher relief, indicating relative importance. This motif of the happy couple continues in Etruscan funerary art for about 400 years. How often does the iconography of marriage remain unchanged in a culture for this long? Do we still use Elizabethan-style family tomb markers with their hierarchy of scale showing a large and therefore important man and his diminutive wife and children? Well, not in my family. By comparison, another sarcophagus lid from Vulci, dated to about 300 BC, shows another couple, Larth Tetnius and Thaqvil Tarnai, very clearly reclining in their marital bed. They're nude, their bodies concealed by a blanket. Unlike the sarcophagus of the spouses, their heads rest on their pillows, and they have their arms around each other, looking directly into each other's eyes, unaware of any audience. The image is intimate, very personal, and seemingly casual. And it's not unique, as other examples from Vulci show the same scene. Notably, in each example, the faces are individualized, perhaps not exactly portraits, but at least attempts at portraiture. The objective was to portray an actual couple in a real, if idealized, relationship. That relationship is centered around the marriage bed, symbol of the heart of the family and the imagery of equality, Again, it's their bed. Contrast this with the famous scene near the end of Homer's Odyssey, when Odysseus returns home and proves his identity by describing the marriage bed he built personally by hand and the house that he built around that bed. Although the imagery is of the centrality of the bed to the household, it's described as his bed and his house, not their bed and their house. Penelope, his wife, shares it, but it belongs to Odysseus. For the Romans, a very telling definition of family is found in the myth of Aeneas. When he fled Troy, he brought with him his father, his son, and his household gods. All of the elements needed to transfer his family into the new land they were settling in Italy. No wife, nor even any female relatives at all, were needed to define family. No such notion of male creation or definition of the family is found in the Etruscan world. Family, for the Etruscans, had a definition, form, and manifestation seemingly unique in the ancient Mediterranean. Marriage, the core relationship defining family, was remarkably, scandalously for the Greek authors, one of equality between husband and wife. I think that the Etruscan notion of family is one that would be far more familiar to us today. It projects a sense of the modern that's missing from that of its contemporary neighbors.